So we are doing the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which is called Vibhuti Yoga. So Vibhuti means the glories of the Lord. And in this particular chapter, the Lord's glories have been described. And they use Vibhuti and Yoga. Yoga, of course, means the science. But also Yoga means how I can join to the higher. So how can I know the Lord? Through all his glories, and they will be described later in the chapter. And through that, how can I discover the Lord in my heart as my own life, as my own breath, as the life of my life, the breath of my breath. So that is the essence of this chapter. So through seeing him in things and beings and realizing he is everywhere, I then ultimately discover that he is everywhere, including in me. And that is what we sometimes forget. That he is in me as the life. In fact, ultimately that is alone is the reality. Everything else that we see is just a superimposition or projection. But ultimately that Lord alone is everywhere. And that is what the great saints and the great teachers repeatedly tell us. So in the last verse, in the last week, Arjuna praises the Lord in verse number 12 and 13. He says, O Lord, you are the Param Brahma, Param Dhamma. You are the supreme abode. You are the great Brahman, the supreme consciousness. You are the purifier. Chanting your name, remembering your glories purifies the heart. You are the eternal Purusha, Shashvatam Divyam. Eternal, resplendent Purusha, the spirit, the life within us. And you are Ajam, you are unborn. There was never a day when the Lord was not. And you are Vibhum, you are all pervading. Everywhere there is no place you are not. And how do we know that? How can we know that? So Arjuna quotes some great rishis or some great sages who had described the Lord. And he talks about great rishis like Devarshi Narada, Asita, Devala, Vyasa. They have all described your glories and swayan chaiva bravishime, and you yourself have told me that you are the all-pervading reality. So that is the essence of so far what we have studied, that the Lord says, I am that reality, and Arjuna says, I believe it. But now Arjuna wants proof. We'll go to verse number 14, chapter 10, verse 14. Sarvametadritam manye. Yanmam vadasi Keshava. Nahite Bhagavan Vyaktim. Vidur Devana Danavaha. So sarvam etat ritam manye. Sarvam etat. Etat means this. Sarvam means all this. Ritam manye. I consider it the truth. Yes, I have heard from you. And I have heard from all the great authorities, the great rishis. Vyas and Naradji and Devala and all these great rishis. So I believe it. See, that is the first factor in any study is faith. Unless you have faith in the teacher, you will never learn anything. Whether you are in sports, you know, you have a coach and who is teaching you how to play football or basketball, and you say, I don't like this teacher. The moment you say, I don't like this teacher, your learning stops. Then you can never learn from that person. So the first factor in learning is you have to like the studies and you have to like the teacher. So when you have faith in the teacher and when you like the teacher, then you are bound to learn. If you don't, then your success is never happen. So sarvam etad ritam manye. And I manye means I understand. I accept that this is all the truth. Lord, you are telling the truth. And the teachers were telling the truth. Yan mam vadasi keshava. Yan means yat. Actually it is yat, but because of sandhi it becomes yan. Because of Sandhi rules, but he says, Yat Mam Vadasi Keshava. And this Mam, you are telling me, Keshava. Keshava is one of Krishna's names. Keshava means because he had beautiful curly hair. If you look at him in all his pictures, he had beautiful black, long curly hair. And Swamiji in his commentary also says that Keshava has another meaning, that when you surrender to him, he gives you great joy. That is true. When you surrender to the Lord and approach him with love and humility and say, Lord, you are everything in my life, then automatically your mind becomes filled with love. So Keshava has two meanings. Yanmam Vadasi Keshava, your manifestation, your personality, O Lord Bhagavan, your personality, O Lord, na vidur deva na danvaha, na viduhu, na neither the devas or the danavas understand. The devas represent the gods in heaven, all the good beings, and the danavaha represent the demons, the evil. So he says, neither the good nor the evil know you, neither even the lords in heaven do not know you, whether it's Indra or Vayu or, you know, we in our Puranas, we talk about all the gods in heaven. Indra, the god of thunder and rain, and then there is Vayu, the lord of air, and then there is Surya Bhagavan, the lord of sun. And it is said that they are the celestial beings who run the entire universe, all the planets and everything are maintained by them. And then they are constantly fighting with demons. Demons are the evil beings who are fighting against the devas, and they want to control heaven because heaven is where the power is, where the whole universe is controlled from heaven. Even in the Bible, they talk about, you know, Shaitan, the devil, who is always fighting against God for control of the humans. So it says that neither the danavas nor the devas know you. You say, okay, I understand the danavas, the demons may not know him, but even the gods in heaven, they don't know, then you know, what mera kaha chance hai? What do a chance I have? Then what am I wasting my time? Then maybe I should go and watch football because the game will be starting at 12 o'clock. So I should be watching the Ravens. So no, but there is, you know, human beings can reach him, can know him. And that's what the essence of these scriptures is, that you can know. So he says they do not know him. So what is the meaning of using the two devas and danavas? As we said, devas are the good and danavas are the evil, and they are all the time fighting. But this is very symbolic, because in our life also, we have in our heart both. We have the devas and we have the danavas. We have the gods and we have the demons. We have the good tendencies, you know, that I say, I must do good, I must do a lot, I must help others. And then there are the evil tendencies which say, what is the need, you know, to do that? Enjoy life, khao piyo, maja karo. You know, like the good tendency might say, I have to get up in the morning and meditate, you know, and I put my alarm, and, you know, and then at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's dark outside, it's so cold, and the bed feels so cozy, so I turn off the alarm and go back to sleep. Or you know, Swamiji is here and I have to go to the lecture, it's Friday evening, and then somebody says, you know what, but there is a party in town. You know, it'll be more fun. You know, what's the use of going to, you know, wasting your time? You know, you can always read it. So what I'm saying is, I'm supposed to study. You know, I have finals coming up. And then my friend calls, you know, let's go to a movie. Come on, you know, you can study at night. It's easy, the final. So same thing. You know, there is always a conflict between the good and the evil, the right and the wrong. And the question is, who wins? Do you take the side of the good and you do what is right, or you say, it's okay, you know, I don't need to do well, it's fine? So in our heart, there is a constant fight between good and evil. That's what the Mahabharata also represents. You know, in the Mahabharata, they have the 5 good cousins and the 100 evil brothers, and they are constantly fighting with each other. And the Lord comes on the side of the Pandavas, and that's why the Pandavas win the battle. So similarly, they say that when the Lord is with you, then your good side wins. So when they say that the good nor the evil cannot know you, you say, if the evil cannot know me, I understand. But even if I am good, I cannot know the Lord. What they mean is that good and evil are both concepts of the mind and the intellect, right? The intellect decides this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad. this I like, this I don't like. So they are the concepts of the mind and the intellect. But the mind and the intellect cannot know him, cannot know the Lord, that is the subject. It cannot become an object. You cannot say, I'm going to think about Brahman and then I'll know what is Brahman. Brahman can never become an object. God can never become an object. God is the subject because of whom I am able to function. So my mind and intellect is able to function because of this consciousness. And they gave many examples, like I have a telescope. Now the telescope, I use the telescope and I can see the furthest planets and the stars and all the, you know, so close by. I can see everything. But the telescope can see everything else in the universe. But can the telescope see the person who is watching? Telescope cannot, right? Telescope cannot see the person who is watching through the telescope, the whole universe. So similarly, it is the consciousness that is working through our mind and intellect. And the mind and intellect can perceive. The mind can feel the emotions. The intellect can think about the thoughts. My body, my sense organs can see, hear, smell, taste, and touch. So I can see, hear, smell, taste, and touch, but I cannot see God. I can see everything else. I cannot even contemplate about him. I cannot even think about him. They say, then what is the use of all the scriptures? What the scriptures tell us, that when your mind is quiet, so when you read the scriptures, you come to know that the Lord is the essence in my heart. He is the consciousness. So what the scriptures say, that when your mind becomes completely quiet, when you sit for meditation, you sit for puja, or when you do a lot of service, again your mind becomes quiet. So in that silence, you experience that he is the life in me. And in that experience, then I disappear. Then I disappear and he alone remains. So like, you know, last week we had talked about when they say Aham Brahmasmi, I am God or I am Brahman, it does not mean that I, the individual, Anil or Pankaj or Arun, or I cannot be God. But what it means is that when I disappear, then God alone remains. Just as the wave appears, but the wave says, I am the ocean who at this moment is occupying the part of a wave. But when the wave hood disappears, the wave says, I am no longer the wave, I am the ocean. At this moment, yes, I am a tiny little wave, but in reality, I am the ocean. Then he can understand that all waves are me, because they are all the one ocean. So when the ego disappears, then the person understands that I am nothing but that consciousness, and everything in the universe is that consciousness. So it does not mean I, the individual, I cannot create the universe. I cannot create a plant. I cannot create a blade of grass. But I as the consciousness, when I disappear and that consciousness appears, in that silence, you can understand that there is only one consciousness, and I and everything are the manifestation of that. Then that separation does not happen. And that is what these great rishis and these great saints experience. They, when they sit in the silence of their meditation, they experience that, the oneness. And then they can see the one Lord everywhere. There is a very beautiful story which kind of illustrates that how the devas or the danavas cannot experience that. This is, comes from Rajneesh. And the story goes like this, that once there was a girl who was very pretty, and she was in her house and her door was closed. And this young man loved her very much, and he wanted to marry her, and he wanted to meet her. And so he comes and knocks at the door. And so she says, who is there? So he very proudly says, it's me. I am your beloved. I'm here to take you. Door doesn't open. He waits, waits. Nothing happens. So he gets very disappointed. You know, what happened? I love her so much. He said, maybe I said something wrong. So he goes and wanders around for 2-3 months. and thinks and thinks and thinks, and he says, you know what, I think I was too arrogant. You know, maybe I should go more humbly. So he goes and knocks on the door a little softly. First time he had banged on the doors. This time he knocks. And she says, who is there? He says, I am your beloved. I love you. You are everything. I am nothing. You are the light of my life, and you are the moon in my star, and all that. But very humbly, very softly. She says, it's a little better, but the door still doesn't open. So he says, you know, I tried the humility. I tried pride, and it didn't work. Maybe still there is some deficiency. So he goes around and walks and spends a year thinking about it. Finally, he comes and knocks very, very softly, just barely. And so she says, who's there? He doesn't say anything. And she says, who is there? And he just silently waits. And that's the time she opens the door and embraces him. So the idea being that the Lord cannot be a subject of arrogance, that I am going to get him. You know, like the Danavas, they wanted to challenge the good. So you cannot say, I'm going to challenge the Lord, I'm going to possess him because I know so much, I have read all the Upanishads, and I am a great scholar, I am a very knowledgeable, I am very powerful, I have studied this, I have gotten my PhD in Sanskrit, scripture. No, that doesn't work. Or you say, oh Lord, you are all powerful, you are all great, and I am nothing. That is good. You know, where at least you are accepting humbly that the Lord is the all-powerful creator of this universe and has also created me, and I am his humble servant, and that is good. But in that silence, when your ego disappears, when you sit for meditation or you sit for puja, you finally reach that state where you experience oneness with the Lord, where I am nothing, I am not even separate from him. First, an idea is I am his humble servant, and that is good. I am serving the Lord. When I am helping somebody poor, you know, I say I go and feed the homeless, or I clean the park, or I do something good, you know, some go and work in the library. And first of all, you can say, I am a great social servant. You know, I am such a wonderful, I have done so much for everybody. You know, that is arrogance. Second, you say, whatever I have done, you know, I am a humble servant of the Lord. And that is better. But in the third stage is where I do not exist. The Lord alone is. The Lord is working through me. The Lord is working. And the ones whom I am serving are the Lord too. So there is no separation. There is no separation between me and the Lord. And that oneness happens. So that is what is the essence of this particular beautiful shloka. That you cannot know him through arrogance. You cannot know him through humility. You have to become him. You have to become one with him. And that can only happen in the silence of your, when you sit in silence and you are meditating upon that truth constantly, then that ego disappears, the perceiver, feeler, thinker disappears, the whole world disappears, and the Lord alone is. And similarly, not only in the path of meditation, but say for a devotee, for a bhakta who has total identification with the Lord, where there is no separation with the Lord or me. There's another beautiful, there are so many stories you can tell about this. There was this, of course, the story of Mirabai, you have all know. Mirabai was a great saint from Rajasthan in India who loved God Krishna as my husband. So she said, he is my husband. She didn't, even though she was married, she left her husband. And she said, the Lord is my husband and I want to love him. I want to be. And she composed thousands of beautiful bhajans, beautiful songs, which even till today are sung in all over India, where there were beautiful songs of love for the Lord. Not only love, but also a lot of good messages there, a lot of good teachings are there in those bhajans. So it is said that she always loved Lord as a husband, as somebody I love. And her love was so strong that even her own family opposed her. Her husband, her father-in-law, who was the king, didn't want her, but she resisted. Even they tried to poison her. But there is an incident in her life which is not very covered in many books, it is that when she finally, it was time for her to leave the body, it is said that what happened was that there was this Krishna temple where she used to always go and visit. And by then she had developed a large following. A lot of people used to sing her songs and consider her a great saint. And it is said that when it was time to leave her body, they were all following her, you know, because she was singing bhajans. And she told the people, "You wait outside, you know, outside the temple. I just want to go in alone." And there was nobody in the temple. And it is said she went into the temple and she didn't come out for an hour, 2 hours. And people were wondering, what happened to her? Where did she go? She hasn't come out. I hope she's okay. Because by then she was a little older in age and all. And it is said in that story that when they walked into this temple, they found only her clothes. Her body had disappeared and merged with that consciousness. Her clothes alone were left there. So the idea is that at the height of the devotion or height of love is to feel the oneness. Similarly, like we have, when we love our child, we feel, a mother feels so much oneness. You know, if something happens to the child may be, you know, 5,000 miles away, but the mother is feeling it. My child is not well, or my child is hurting, and she's constantly thinking. So that total identification is the zenith of love. So that is what it is said in here, that to know him is to become him, to become one with him. So that is why he says, nobody can know you except you yourself. Any questions, any comments? Well, yes, the mind is a problem until you have reached that complete silence. Yeah, when you are on the path, mind is definitely a problem. When you sit for meditation or you sit for puja or for prayers, your mind is an obstacle. But in that silence, even the mind becomes quiet. Of course, it does not mean that the person's mind is dead, but the mind becomes silent. And when the person comes out of meditation and has experienced that total mind, the total silence, then there are two concepts of our mind. One is the functional mind and one is the judgmental mind. So the functional mind is that I have to get up now after this class, I have to go to work, or I have to have lunch. So that is a functional mind. That mind always remains. As long as this body is there, that functional mind will remain. That I have to change my clothes, I have to take a shower, I have to do my go to work, go to my job and all. So the functional mind remains. But then there is a judgmental mind, which judges situations and people. You know, this is good, this is bad, this I like, this I don't like. I like this food, I don't like this food, I like this person, I don't like. So that judgmental mind goes away. And in a saint, they do not judge people. They accept people as they are. First of all, they have universal love for all. And they also accept, even somebody is bad, they accept him. Okay, he's bad. That is how he is. They do not have any hatred. They do not have any love. They do not have any special love for some people or a special hatred for anybody. They accept people as they are. Even Eckhart Tolle in his Power of Now, he talks about that, the acceptance. So that judgmental mind goes away. And that is the one that causes us all the problems. When I'm meditating, when I'm working, when I'm praying, even when I'm doing my activity, you know, I'm doing something. I'm supposed to do something, right? This is my project. Say, I don't like this work. You know, there are two parts of this. I'll do this part and this I'll give to somebody else. Or I even studying, you know, I study the subjects I like and I don't study the subjects I dislike. So this likes and dislikes is the problem. Even in the second chapter, Krishna says that do your duty, vigat jvaraha. You know, without worrying about likes and dislikes, success and failure, you do what is your duty. So when you do your duty without likes and dislikes, without regard for, you know, my comforts or my, like this job is comfortable, so I'll do it. This job is uncomfortable, I won't do it. So for a saint or for a wise person, whatever job is assigned, he does it cheerfully, whether he likes it or doesn't like it, whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable. But for you and me, we have this idea, this is good, you know, let me do it. And for this person is good person, so I should help him. The other guy, I don't care too much for. So that judgmental mind is the problem, and that's the mind that creates all the problems, not the functional mind. So in that silence of meditation, that judgmental mind disappears. And once the saint has realized the truth, then that mind no longer bothers him. I think, you know, like in a situation where somebody is really, really bad, you know, and one is you can try to help that person to get better. But if the person refuses to change and doesn't want to get better, then you say, okay, that's how he is. That is his nature. And you accept him as he is. And, you know, and sometimes when you accept, you actually can change that person's nature as opposed to fighting or resenting it. And ultimately, you say, that's how he is. And maybe he'll change in the next life or somewhere in the future. So you accept the person, but you do not have any inner hatred for the person. That's why, you know, he says, no, hate the sin, not the sinner. I think Jesus said that. Hate the sin. What this person is doing is wrong. And if I can stop it, I will stop it. Say if somebody's like stealing a car or whatever, obviously you can call the police or try to stop. But inside, you don't have any hatred for the person that is. I think that's the intellect. The intellect which knows what is right, what is wrong, is telling the mind. Actually, they say in meditation, the mind itself watches the mind. So what there is one aspect of the mind that is watching the other aspect. So as the consciousness, you watch both of them. You watch the one that is talking and the one that is telling it to stop. But you are none of those. They are both aspects of the mind. Any thoughts that arise, whether good thoughts or bad thoughts, they are still thoughts. Whether I'm thinking of, you know, Krishna playing the flute or Jesus on the Christ, or I'm thinking of, you know, I have just watched on the 11 o'clock news some murder happening, and I'm thinking of the murderer. Whether I'm thinking of good or bad, they are still thoughts. And even that thought, telling the thought to stop thinking, is still a thought. So as a consciousness, I have to be a witness of both those thoughts. And ultimately, when you identify with the consciousness and watch the mind, watch the two aspects of the mind, ultimately the mind becomes silent. And in that silence, then you feel that inner peace and that inner joy. So you, in your meditation, you constantly identify with that witnessing consciousness. And I am that consciousness. I am not this body. I am not the mind. I am not the intellect. I am not the desires. But I am that consciousness. You know, Nirvan Shatakam, everybody should read or memorize Shankaracharya's. That six verses is very beautiful. Mano, Buddha, Ahankara. I think everybody, whoever meditates, must read and memorize that. You can get it on the internet and get a good translation of that. And that is wonderful. The six verses are beautiful for meditation. Shankaracharya, in one short place, he has totally summarized what is meditation.